Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is January the 28th. We're in Senate Finance, the state capital. We have a quorum here. Senator Stedman, Senator Olson is continued to be excused. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick should be coming shortly. Senator Kaufman, Senator Kronk. Today, we're going to continue the overview of the FY 2026 governor's budget from OMB, focusing on the 10-year plan initially, and following with the overview of the governor's budget from the Legislative Division of Finance Division. So I'd like to invite Stacey Sanders back to the table and continue her presentation on the 10-year fiscal outlook for the state of Alaska. And if she could focus on, Senator Stedman asked to focus on primarily the next 3 years, which are going to be the most difficult. Ms. Sanders, identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Director for the Office of Management and Budget. Thank you for having me again today. We'll walk through the last slide of the presentation this morning. As the committee is aware, Alaska statute requires the governor to publish a 10-year fiscal outlook that balances sources of revenues with uses of funds while providing essential state services and protecting the economic stability of the state. This slide represents a condensed version of that plan. The plan can be found on the Office of Management and Budget's website, and a link has been provided at the end of the presentation to the full report. The 10-year plans have varied from year to year, and over the years that Governor Dunleavy has been in office, he has proposed various versions of what a 10-year fiscal outlook could look like. This year's approach presents a status quo 10-year outlook. The status quo is clearly unsustainable, with savings being depleted in fiscal year 2028. The governor acknowledges that some combination of revenue measures and reductions in spending will have to occur before the state savings accounts are depleted. Policymakers will need to continue those conversations this year in order to address the structural deficits that our state faces. And the governor is willing to participate in those conversations. Those are my remarks, and I'm happy to take questions regarding the 10-year fiscal outlook.
My question again is, as the governor leading this state, we and the people of Alaska look toward him to give us some direction. Are we going to get any direction from the third floor regarding the imbalance of our budget and additional new revenues?
Chair Hoffman, at this time, the governor is not introducing any new revenue measures. In the conversations with the governor, his experience has been that when he has proposed revenue measures in the past 10-year fiscal outlooks, there's been criticism or there's been a lack of an appetite in the legislative body to pass those measures. The governor is willing to have the conversation and recognizes that it is not him that is passing those measures, that it is the legislative body, and that it's going to take more than just him pushing forward a revenue measure. So, but at this time, to answer your question, no, there are no revenue measures coming forward.
But I think the times have changed since the last time he introduced those, and it's clear to people of Alaska and imminent that that has to be addressed. So I would encourage the governor to come forward, since he is the single individual in the state that provides the potential leadership to come up with some issues that can be a starting point for this dialogue. So I would encourage that. Do we have any? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it'd be nice to know the governor's current position on the dividend. I recognize that your comment yesterday that in statute he's, you know, required to put a balanced budget on the table. And this, there is a statutory dividend. There's also the 5% cap in statute of the permanent fund. What is the governor's position on the dividend? And does his math work? That's the other question that has to follow up.
Chair, co-chairs Hoffman and Stedman, I'm happy to have those conversations and bring those messages back to him again.
Because, quite frankly, we have a requirement to balance our budget, and I would say that that should apply to the 10-year plan as well. And clearly, when you're looking into the year 2023, when you have a $12 billion deficit, that does not balance. And it looks to me that the future of Alaska on this 10-year fiscal outlook is worse than bleak. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sanders, I could probably use a history refresher. I do recall the governor putting the concept of revenue in past 10-year plans. I appreciate that. What's coming to mind for revenue bills, I'm remembering the two carbon bills, trees and rocks. And if memory serves, both those bills introduced by the governor to generate new revenue passed. What other bills has the governor introduced to generate new state revenue that got the reception you described earlier?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, you have a good point. I was referring to proposals in the plans themselves and the 10-year outlooks and revenue potential changes that would be needed to balance the budget. You are correct. The two proposals that were put forward were adopted.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel, just an observation on that. I think the governor's batting 1,000 on the leadership move to actually introduce the legislation that solves a problem and push it through. So I would just echo Ms. Sanders, the chairman's remarks, that the governor plays a unique leadership role, swings a big stick. And when it comes to it's coming up on a $12 billion problem, that would be that may be what it takes.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Any additional questions or comments on the 10-year fiscal outlook as presented by OMB? Senator Stedman.
Just as a kind of a broader point of discussion, Mr. Chairman, I think we should concentrate on around FY 28, shown here at negative almost $1 billion. And we'll have a new administration then because the governor will be timed out. And is that the position we want to leave the state in for the next governor? Broke with no ability to raise revenues to facilitate that upcoming budget that he'd have to submit through that legislative process if it takes us a year and a half, 2 years to put in revenue if we decide to do that or reduce expenditures. A lot of those are contractual obligations. So I think landing on 2028 at almost negative $1 billion is unacceptable course in any way you measure it. So I think we should ask OMB and to help us alleviate that issue and show us how the math works so we don't end up there. That's certainly not a statutory dividend that some folks in the building still advocate.
And it should be pointed out that just because a bill gets passed, the implementation and the collection of additional revenue takes time. And that should be noted by people at this table, the general public, and particularly the current administration. Thank you for your presentation. We'll go to... take a brief at ease while we switch. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The second part of the presentation is going to be by the Legislative Finance Division, Alexi Painter. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter. I'm the Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And often in this first meeting where we do our overview, I would introduce all the analysts. A lot of them are in other meetings, so I'm just going to introduce them by name but not in the room here. So in addition to being the director of the division, I also am the analyst for the governor, Office of the Governor's Budget and the Legislature's Budget. Our deputy director, Rob Carpenter, is the analyst for the Department of Administration, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and the Department of Law. He also was the lead analyst behind the publication of Senator Kaufman's bill, which required a new report this last year on inactive funds. Morgan Foss is our operating budget coordinator and is the analyst for the Department of Fish and Game. Michael Partlow is our capital budget coordinator and is the analyst for the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Military and Veterans Affairs, Transportation, and University of Alaska. Connor Bell is another fiscal analyst who is responsible for revenue analysis, was the publisher of the indirect expenditure report that just came out, although there was no agencies for us to analyze, so it was a one-page report this year. He also does our fiscal modeling and is the analyst for the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Education and Early Development, Revenue, and Corrections. Valerie Rose is our fiscal note coordinator and is also the analyst for the Departments of Family and Community Services, Health, and Labor and Workforce Development. And finally, we have a new analyst this year, Nathan Teal, who's the analyst for the Judiciary, Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Public Safety. So hopefully you'll have a chance to meet them all, but I know several of them were in meetings and we didn't want to just trot out half of them right now. So with that, I'll proceed with my presentation.
Before you begin, Senator Giesel has been here since the beginning of the meeting. I'd like to recognize her. Mr. Painter.
All right, so we're going to start by doing a recap of last year and then how we got to this year, including the fall revenue forecast. We'll cover the governor's FY26 budget and then go to the long-term view. So when the legislature adjourned last year, based on the budget we passed, there was a projected budget surplus in both FY24 and FY25 based on the spring Department of Revenue forecast. That was $66.3 million in FY24, $7.8 million in FY25, so pretty close to the wire there. And we also didn't include any provision to fill a potential deficit in FY25 if revenue fell short of that spring forecast. So while we did pass a balanced budget, there was not a lot of margin for error because there was nothing that would happen if we didn't have enough money, essentially kicking the can down to this legislature to deal with if that came true. Capital budget totaled $565.5 million of UGF across both FY24 supplementals and FY25. So last year's legislature had a surplus in the current fiscal year as it was then, FY24, and so a lot of the capital spending was put into the supplemental budget. When you do year-by-year comparisons of the capital budget, it's sometimes helpful to look at session by session because really capital appropriations can take effect either year, and it helps you get a truer sense. So when we do the comparisons of the governor's capital budget to last year, we'll both look at last fiscal year and last session because that's kind of a fuller picture of what the legislature had to work with last year. The legislature's budget also included $175 million of outside the formula K-12 funding. It was $680 for the BSA. That's about 11% of the total foundation funding. It came from that outside the formula appropriation. A few notable things also in the legislature's budget. There were several moves made to attempt to avoid routine supplementals that we've seen year after year. So we approved several increases to the Department of Corrections that the governor put forward and then added an additional amount for part of another item that was had been in the FY24 supplemental. We increased funding for fire suppression activity, it should say, not preparedness, and then the Disaster Relief Fund to try to avoid routine supplementals. And the legislature also fully funded all the statewide operating items to their statutory levels other than the permanent fund dividend. So then the governor, as he was signing the bill, exercised his line item veto power. The table summarizes where those vetoes were in terms of operating and capital and across the two fiscal years. In the operating budget, most of those vetoes were in FY25, just one small one in FY24, totaling $83.2 million of unrestricted general funds. Some of these will come back, so I'm going to cover a few of the large ones here. We'll come back throughout our discussion. The largest UGF operating budget veto was $20 million to the Community Assistance Fund. There had been a past veto of an appropriation of that fund, so the $20 million would have brought the total fund balance up to $90 million. By statute, that program will distribute a third of the fund balance on July 1st each year, so if the up to $90 million, so that $90 million balance would have allowed for a $30 million distribution from the fund in fiscal year 26. With that veto, the amount that would go out in FY26 would instead be reduced. There was $11.9 million to school districts to satisfy a federal maintenance of equity requirement that dates back to FY22. Subsequently, in December, the federal government reversed course and said that they no longer require additional funds for that, that the outside the formula funds would satisfy that requirement. So that veto did reduce what went to school districts, but wasn't necessary to satisfy that requirement. The governor reduced the amount going to the broadband assistance grants by $11 million. The legislature had also funded significantly below the fiscal note for that program. The projections were coming in significantly lower than the original fiscal note, in part due to the timing where of when the bill passed versus when districts had to apply. The governor vetoed $10 million for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and $10 million for the Alaska Marine Highway Backstop funding. Based on the amount of the federal grant we received this year, with that veto, there is sufficient federal revenue to run the schedule that was appropriated by the legislature. So that veto, again, didn't really end up having an impact, assuming federal funds are dispersed as appropriated by by Congress. The governor vetoed $7.5 million for the Disaster Relief Fund, and we'll see that one coming back in a bit. $5.4 million for UAF's Tier 1 research, and then $5.2 million of additional funds that would have gone out to students in grades K through 3. The governor vetoed a fair amount of capital projects. It was about a third of the UGF supplementals in FY24, 12% of the UGF FY25 projects. Most of the things he vetoed were projects in legislative districts, so those legislative additions that went out in particular districts. So when the governor signed the bill with all those vetoes, there was a projection of a nearly $147 million budget surplus based on the spring revenue forecast. So when we had adjourned, it was looking at like $7.8 million, pretty tight with the vetoes. There was a bit more breathing room. However, the fall revenue forecasts came out and decreased the FY25 projection by even more than that. So that turned our projected surplus into a projected deficit of $81.5 million before counting any supplementals. So since that, there was no deficit filler in the FY25 budget. That is an unfilled deficit that will likely need to be addressed this session unless oil prices rise significantly above where they are right now to close it. They have been a little bit above the fall forecast since it's come out, but not enough to erase that deficit, and certainly not enough to pay for anticipated supplemental needs. So more about the fall revenue forecast. The fall revenue forecast that you heard from Department of Revenue about last week shows lower oil prices and production in both FY25 and 26. This top table compares revenue, shows that in FY25 the projection is down about $220 million, in FY26 about $230 million. The price is down about $4 in each year from the previous projection. Production is down as well. And then lease expenditures, which are the costs that oil companies are incurring that they're able to deduct, are up significantly nearly $800 million in FY25 and $450 million or so in FY26. The effect of that is because those are deducted against the production tax calculation, even if we hit the same price as projected in the spring forecast, we would get less revenue. So for FY25, even if we hit the original $78 that was forecast back last year, based on the higher lease expenditure forecast, we'd have about $90 million less in revenue. So it's not just a matter of the price and production being down. It's also these lease expenditures going up. Some of that's the capital expenditures that on the North Slope that are going to lead to future production. Some of it is just operating expenditures continue to rise for the producers. So this next graph shows the daily oil prices going back a couple of years to November 2022, so it shows you basically the last two forecasts worth. And it's important to show this daily fluctuation, I think, because sometimes when you're zoomed in, you see little peaks like we had last week and think, well, we're on a rocket ship to the stars. We're going to go up to $100 and things are going to solve. And then a week later, it dips back down. And when you zoom out, it just looks like a little blip. The reality is that in the forecast price range, every dollar change in oil prices changes annual revenue by $35 to $40 million. That used to be a higher number, but as we kind of creep towards the lease expenditures increase, the marginal revenue that we get from each dollar decreases. So now that's about $35 to $40 million. So you can see that sort of swing in a day or two very easily with oil prices. So it's important to not get too attached to a particular forecast number or what things are looking like in a particular day, because it really can be quite volatile over time, and that can have a very large impact on our available revenue.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If memory serves me correctly, I think a couple of years ago we were using $75 per dollar. Now we're in the $35 to $40 range per dollar movement in price. Is that
through the chair, Senator Stedman? Yes, that's correct. I think 2 years ago maybe it was $70 or $70 million per dollar.
The good old days. Please proceed.
So our largest source of revenue and the most stable at this point is the percent of market, well, our largest source of unrestricted general fund revenue, I should say. Our largest source of revenue is federal revenue. But our largest source of unrestricted general fund revenue is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. That's calculated on a lagged 5-year average of the market value of the fund. So in the current fiscal year, FY25, that is 5% of the average fund balance from FY19 through 23. Then in FY26, that switches to FY20 through 24. So that number is now known. FY24 is over. We have a established number. So for building the FY26 budget, we have a stable number of about $3.8 billion that we know we can spend. And note that that number increased significantly over FY25 because we've replaced that $66 billion balance from FY19 with the $80 billion balance in FY24. That leads to a significant increase. We'll see that again next year as the $65 billion balance from FY20 is replaced by something probably in the $80 billion range in FY25. But after that, that huge spike we saw in FY21 with the big returns will be worked in, so we should expect less annual increase in that POMV draw from year to year. That's certainly helping us right now in terms of working that into the average and seeing a significant increase in the POMV every year. But once that big spike is worked in, we won't see, you know, $140 million increases year by year like we have the last couple of years.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we have Mr. Painter come back to the committee with a chart similar to this but using the realized earnings, which is the statutory dividend basis for the calculation of the statutory dividend? And I think you'll see some anomalies embedded within that, and maybe you can have him actually look back a couple years beyond, you know, what was the last couple years that were dropped off, because I recall there was some real estate sold and some other things that artificially increased that linear trend of the dividend calculation.
Through the chair, I'd be happy to bring that back to the committee. This next graph is a budget sensitivity chart for our current fiscal year, FY25. I'm not going to really talk about this too much. I think last year I talked about it more because that energy relief we had put in was more in play. This year it's a little bit out of reach unless prices spike. When we passed the budget last year, there was a provision that said if revenue exceeded, was more than $135 million above the spring forecast, then we would get additional revenue that would be split into an energy relief check and go into savings. Since we're under the forecast, we'd have to have prices go up quite a bit for that to happen, so I'm not really going to talk about the likelihood of that or the effect. I think what's important here is just to show that we're in this red part, the unfilled deficit. Based on the fall forecast, we are in that little area, just a tip at this point, where we cannot actually pay out the full FY25 budget based on the forecast. Okay, so the governor has, at this point, a partial supplemental budget. Director Sanders covered that in her presentation, so I won't go over it too much. But the governor introduced both a fast-track bill and then there's a supplemental appropriation, or a few of them, in the governor's regular operating bill as well. So in the fast-track bill, there's two items. There's $50 million of UGF to to ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, for an Alaska liquefied natural gas contract. There's $15 million of UGF to the Disaster Relief Fund. So you may recall that the governor had vetoed $7.5 million that the legislature put in. The governor is now asking for $15 million, so twice that vetoed amount, to add to the Disaster Relief Fund. I think Director Sanders covered the situation with that last week. They've had to borrow from the deferred maintenance appropriation in order to make disaster payments. And obviously with the announcement last night that the federal government may be putting a hold on some of the federal disaster payments, that could potentially worsen the cash flow situation if we're not getting reimbursements. In addition to the fast-track items, the governor's operating bill includes a $10 million supplemental appropriation to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. You may recall he vetoed a $10 million appropriation, but this one comes back in as a multi-year. That was a single-year appropriation. This one would be spent over the course of 3 years versus just 1 year in the legislature's budget last year. The operating budget includes a draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund for FY25 up to $200 million. Just a note on that, if the fast-track bill is to be passed before the operating bill, that CBR vote really needs to be in the fast-track bill. The governor can't sign appropriations from the general fund if there's a deficit. We have to fill that deficit. So if you'd like those $65 million of UGF appropriations, there needs to be a CBR vote along with that in order to pay for those. And so that would need to move into that other bill, unless you're passing the operating bill and supplemental bill simultaneously, in which case it's not really so much of a fast track. But that's just kind of a technical point about timing. We're expecting additional supplemental requests on the 15th day of the legislative session when they're due, so next week. Those are expected to include items in the Department of Corrections. There's a couple of items that are in their FY26 requests that the department has indicated are also needed in FY25. There is an expected ask for fire suppression. We received on the first day of session a report on spending so far for that. It indicated that the amount that was enacted for that in FY25 was just barely exceeded by expenditures so far, and that doesn't include anything for the spring fire season, so there will need to be an additional amount to pay for that season. And then Medicaid, there was a projection of about $14 million that would be needed based on projections submitted by the department on December 15th, so that will potentially need to be worked in. The department also said that the day after they sent out that projection, they received word about a federal rate increase that could also increase the UGF amount. And so that actual amount of supplemental is being worked on by the Office of Management and Budget, and I'm sure they'll bring us back some updated information next week.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to be grabbing so many questions, but on page 9, we'll back up one. Could we get the dollar amount that would have to go forward on the oil prices to get break even, and then a guesstimate on the dollar price to break even, including supplementals?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So just to make the existing appropriations for FY25 be paid, you'd need a $76 annual oil price. We've actually averaged close to that for the year, so that's perhaps achievable. That $81 million deficit that was projected in the fall forecast could be erased. That wouldn't necessarily be enough for supplementals, but $76 would get us to balance with our current appropriations. And so, speaking to the fast-track supplemental, if we wait until the spring forecast, it's possible that we could afford the fast-track supplemental, but maybe not all of the supplementals, without the need for a CBR vote at that point. Although if you wait till mid-March or so for the fast-track, it's, again, not perhaps not as fast as what the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs would prefer for the Disaster Relief Fund. To start paying out that energy relief, you'd need oil of about $81 a barrel. Since we're at about $76 for the year through half the year, that require the price to be in the mid to upper 80s for the rest of the year, or probably the upper 80s at this point, since we're a bit over half the year, to achieve that for the year. So it's be pretty difficult to get even to the beginning of that appropriation with that $135 million buffer.
Senator Stedman.
And just for clarity for those who don't watch us all the time that may be new to it, what are you talking about? Fast track, slow track, or no track? Are we train tracks? What in the world is? What are you talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So, while appropriation bills can have any number of types of appropriations, the governor submitted what's called a fast track supplemental bill. That means that there's an expectation that it will move more swiftly than being passed at the end of session. Often supplemental appropriations for the current year, while they are needed for the current year, they're not of such urgency that they need to be passed before our regular operating and capital bills. So often supplemental appropriations are rolled into the operating and capital bills at the end of session, or one or the other. When there's a fast-track supplemental bill, that often indicates that there's a more pressing timing. There's a need for the item sooner rather than later. We can't wait until May to pass it and then have it signed the next month. In the case of the Disaster Relief Fund, that fund already is having to borrow from another appropriation to make its cash flow payments. If there's a further disaster, it could be further in the red than they can necessarily just borrow to make those payments. So there's a time pressure on that appropriation that perhaps merits separating it from the regular appropriation bills. And so that would be a fast-track supplemental bill. Sometimes we'll have a separate slow-track supplemental bill, but usually when there's not a fast-track, those are just rolled into the main appropriation bills.
Okay, thank you.
So then moving on to the FY26 budget, the starting point when we go through the budget is what's called the adjusted base. That is the prior year's budget less one-time appropriations and then plus current statewide policy decisions like salary adjustments and formula changes that are needed to maintain services at a status quo level. So that it's a baseline that's prepared by Legislative Finance, and OMB has their version, but we kind of use our own as well. Last year, we changed how we do this to also include those formula changes. Prior, it was really only applied to the numbers changes. So when you're looking at the adjusted base, it's essentially a clean starting point where there's no major policy choices made, and then you can compare the governor's policy choices against that. And I'm not going to talk too much about the formula items, but essentially the adjusted base would be if we partially funded something last year, then we'd assume we partially funded at the same level. We fully funded everything except for the PFD last year, so that really only comes into play for the PFD, where we had funded 25% of the POMV draw, and we would assume that that's the baseline going forward, and the governor's choice to go back to the statutory would be a policy choice. Not super relevant necessarily for the PFD, but for some items that's important because it really helps distinguish policy choices from just automatic formula changes. So the first change we see is one-time items. This looks different than on my computer. I apologize for overlap here. So the largest one-time item that was removed in the adjusted base was that K-12 outside the formula funding that was designated a one-time item by the legislature, so it's backed out when we're building the FY26 budget. There was also the $10 million of unvetoed Alaska Marine Highway backstop, $7.5 million for the child care grant program, $7.3 million for the additional pupil transportation one-time funding, $5 million for tourism marketing, and then some other items I won't get into because they're smaller. By far, the largest of those is the K-12 funding. All the other items total about $53 million of the $228 million of one-time items. So it's important when you're comparing year to year that the governor's budget is really built on the adjusted base, not on last year. So we'll show that he's decreasing the budget compared to last year, but he's increasing it compared to the adjusted base, and that's because first those one-time items are removed before you get into building the next year's budget. There's also significant formula adjustments that partially offset but are pretty significant for the bigger picture that happen in the adjusted base. The K-12 foundation formula is projected to decrease by $28.7 million of UGF. That's based on the numbers that school districts submit to the department. That's primarily due to a significant decline in the number of K-12 students, nearly 3,800 fewer brick-and-mortar students. That's partially offset by an increase in correspondence students, but not enough to increase the funding. There's also some changes in who pays in terms of local contributions and other things, but the biggest thing is that decline in the student count. We can expect that that decline in the student count is going to continue over time based on demographic projections by the Department of Labor. Those projections show that there's fewer children age 0 through 5 than there are ages 6 through 18. So as those kids enter school age, we would expect that the numbers of students in our schools will continue to decline and continue to reduce the amount of the pupil transportation and of the foundation and pupil transportation formulas. That same student count decline is why the pupil transportation formula goes down. That formula is based on a per student amount. The school debt reimbursement program is projected to go down by over $10 million. There's been a moratorium on new school debt going back to FY15, and as a result, we see year by year a decrease in the amount of school debt reimbursement that the state owes back to those districts. That moratorium is scheduled to lift on July 1st of this year, so there will be an ability for districts to go out and bond and get state reimbursement. So we may see that number start to tick up eventually. Even if they bond for a bunch of projects this year, they probably won't have new payments due necessarily July 1st of next year, so it may take a little bit for that to fully work into the formula. The other thing that influences is the bottom item there, the REAA fund, Regional Education Attendance Area Fund Capitalization. That amount is determined based on the previous year's school debt reimbursement amount and is adjusted for the amount of students in small municipal and REAA districts versus in urban districts. So as that school debt reimbursement amount continues to go down, so does the amount going into the REAA fund. And since that school debt reimbursement amount is going down significantly this year, we'll see the REAA fund amount go down significantly next year. Although it's also had dropped a lot this year because that drop is continuing to happen for the school debt program. Other debt service is going down by about $4 million. We have not issued new state bonds in over a decade. The last time we went out for a general obligation bond package was, I think, FY12. So we're seeing that debt slowly leave the books and that amount go down. There was also some refinancing of it that further reduced that debt. And that refinancing was at surprisingly favorable rates, which I'm sure you'll hear about from the Department of Revenue when they bring in their debt projections. But we are seeing that debt continue to go down, and the projections are that our outstanding debt will continue to go down as we have not contracted significant new state debt in over a decade.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, if we continued the moratorium on school bond debt reimbursement, when would that be paid off?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, I believe the last one is not for a long time because they can keep refinancing. I don't remember off the top of my head. It's at least a decade that it's completely paid off, but it does get down to a pretty low number within the next 5 years or so. I don't remember the exact year, and I can get back to the committee with that.
Thank you.
Senator Merrick, thank you. Please proceed.
The big increase in the formula appropriations is the state contributions to retirement. That's going up by $36 million, and that's just the amount that we're paying on behalf of the municipalities and school districts. We'll cover on the next slide the amount that go that of the increase that we're seeing to the state as an employer. So the amount that we owe for both PERS and TERS, or projected to owe, is going up because the past service costs went up in the June 30, 2023, an extra two in there, valuations that that are used to develop the FY26 payment. And so that leads to a significant increase in the amount that we owe for the state contributions to retirement. And Senator Stedman had asked yesterday about, I think it was yesterday, maybe that was all the way last week, it's yesterday, about the whether that's going to the past service cost. The amount that goes in that state contribution to retirement is entirely the past service cost because the capped, the amount under the cap pays the normal cost and then a portion of the past service cost. Everything over the cap is the past service cost, which is also called the unfunded liability or the amount for the prior defined benefit programs.
Senator Stedman.
I was just trying to interrupt to get him to define the term so people at home could follow him. People, a lot of people don't know what a past service cost is and don't care, but they won't be able to follow the conversation unless they understand what a normal cost is, past service cost. And so in essence, what you're talking about is the unfunded liability created from previous tiers that we've been struggling with to pay off for quite a while.
Through the chair, Senator Sedman, that's correct. And, you know, the technical term is past service cost because technically while we're paying this amount to the unfunded liability, we're funding it. We're just funding it year by year. It's not funded based on the normal cost. It's an additional amount that we have to pay to make up for past amounts. So it's often called the unfunded liability, though. That's correct. And we pay a portion of what the state pays as an employer goes to the normal cost, which is just the year-by-year cost, and then a portion of what the state pays as an employer is towards the unfunded liability as well.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Going on to slide 14, there's also significant salary and benefits adjustments, including that first one, the increase to that PERS rate. The state as an employer pays the full rate, and that's paid for with UGF and other fund sources. So it, rather than just the past service liability that we pay for others, is just UGF. This allows us to spread it to other fund sources. I threw in JERS there because there's a very small amount of a JERS amount that we have to pay for the judicial system and had to put it somewhere. Mostly that's that PERS amount. And that's just showing that as the rate goes up, we have to pay more on behalf of state employees for that past service cost or unfunded liability. There's increases in health insurance costs. That's primarily for the employees on AlaskaCare. The union trusts are handled separately through their negotiations. AlaskaCare is the state's health insurance that goes for the exempt employees and for retirees. That amount went up by, I believe, 6.2% this year. There's also several bargaining unit adjustments that these are past contracts that have additional years going in. The legislature does have to approve those amounts each year. Just because we funded it one year doesn't mean we're going to fund it all years. That's a policy decision each year to keep funding that contract. You can see that there's four unions and then the exempt COLA. That's actually in statute, so that one we can't defund quite as easily. And those are based on already agreed to contracts. There's another one for the University of Alaska, salary and benefits for some of their unions, and then also benefits cost increases. Significant increase for the University of Alaska's health care. The reason that's so large is that the University of Alaska self-insures. The state has what's called a group life health fund that's used as kind of a buffer against volatility. They don't have a mechanism like that, so they have significant liabilities due to the past few years during the COVID pandemic where there were higher healthcare costs and a lot of things that now they're having to make up through higher contributions today. So you see a pretty large amount for the University of Alaska's healthcare plan in our salary adjustments. There's also eight executive branch unions and the University of Alaska's largest union that are currently negotiating new contracts. So that includes the general government union in the executive branch. That's our largest union. Nearly half of executive branch employees are in that union. So there may be significant future amendments from the executive branch as those contracts get negotiated. So while we're at about $62 million of UGF, $100 million of total funds already, that's not including potentially a substantial amount for those other unions that are still forthcoming. We may see that over the course of session. There's a statutory deadline of day 60 for those. That is rarely met. Typically, we get those after that deadline, and usually by the time the operating budget gets to this body, we start seeing some of those come in.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've managed the operating budget for many years, but I would, as I recall, a lot of the salary adjustments come in well late into the session and sometimes the last couple of weeks, and some governors have asked us not to fund them, which means we end up paying interest until we fund them. So I think we've pretty much balked at that over the years. We don't negotiate with the appropriators, and we pay it. So I think we need to factor that in as one of our little areas of increases in our budgets this year as we try to balance it, that we don't get surprised with a $30 million bill in the last week of session or some number.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. So noted.
Okay, so slide 15 shows a short fiscal summary of the governor's budget, and Director Sanders covered this, so I'm not going to go over it in too great of depth. In FY25, you can see that we have that $81.5 million deficit before supplementals. The governor has $75 million of supplementals so far that pushed that up over $150 million. In FY26, the governor, you see a decrease in agency operations. And again, as I said, there's $228 million of one-time appropriations that were in FY25 that are not repeated. So when you see that governor, that amount going down, a lot of that is reflecting those one-time items going away. The statewide items are up slightly, and most of that is due to that retirement cost that we talked about. The capital budget is down. We'll talk more about that in greater depth, but as I said earlier, looking at just year to year is kind of understating the amount of the decrease in the capital budget. You know, $48 million or 15% sounds like a lot, but last year we also had a significant amount of the capital budget in the supplemental. This year, facing a deficit in FY25, it's unlikely that we'll be able to use that. So really, the amount available to the legislature for the capital budget is significantly lower than it was last year. The governor then has a statutory PFD estimated there at $2.5 billion, and that results overall in about a $1.5 billion deficit. That would use up about half of the balance of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We'd estimated that balance today is just around $3 billion. And then after the potential draw in FY25, that draw that down a little under $3 billion. And then FY26, draw it down to about $1.6 billion after you factor in investment earnings and new deposits. So about half of the CBR drawn in the governor's budget in FY26 if we adopted it.
Senator Stedman?
I'll ask the question for the chairman because he asked it the other day. How much should we have as a targeted reserve balance in the CBR? Obviously, sometimes we may be higher than that. We could purchase a few more things, do more maintenance. Some years we might be lower than that. What is the range of comfort?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. So there's kind of two purposes of the CBR. One is cash flow, and the other is a shock absorber. And for that cash flow amount, the Department of Revenue has said they need about $400 to $500 million for cash flow. The announcement yesterday from the federal government is a great example of why we also need perhaps a shock absorber. You know, the announcement, for those of you who didn't read the newspaper this morning, is that there's a freeze on a lot of federal spending. If that meant that we weren't getting Medicaid reimbursements for a few weeks, for example, that'd have a significant influence on our cash flow, even if we eventually get that. That's why we need to keep some money in reserve, not just for that regular cash flow, but when events like that happen, having a larger fund balance means you're better able to withstand something coming up, right, like the federal government pausing payments or other unexpected effects. So that's where you get to that shock absorber. That's not just a matter of unexpected deficits. It's things like federal cash flow freezes. That amount is really, there's not anything defined in our statutes about how much you need. Other states have a variety of rules. I would say as a rule of thumb, the less you're dependent on petroleum revenue and its volatile nature, the less you need in the CBR because the less unstable your revenue is. But if you're relying on high oil prices, you probably need a larger buffer. But while we have a $1.5 billion deficit built into your budget, there's really no safe amount in the CBR. You know, in a decade ago, we had $16 billion in savings. We blew through all that in a few years because we just kept running a structural deficit. While you have a structural deficit, there's really no amount that's safe. If you have a balanced budget, we've done calculations based on volatility that show you may want to keep something like $3 billion in the CBR with the balanced budget. But currently, with the governor's budget, we don't have a balanced budget, so that calculation kind of doesn't quite make sense. You'd have to first assume a $1.5 billion change in your spending, and then you can do that calculation. It's a big assumption to make. But a few billion, I would say, is probably what you would want to ensure that you have enough to weather changes in oil prices over a couple of years.
Senator Stedman?
As I recall, looking back in time over different OMB directors and different governors, and there was talk of the, you know, 4 and 5 range in the CBR. And then as things started getting tighter the last several years, that moved down to about 3.5. Last year, the administration was talking about a target of 2.5. And we're sitting right now right under 3. So we're within that comfort range of 3.5. And then, so we have some ability of shock absorber, Mr. Chairman. But we don't have very many years. We don't have 4 or 5 years of cushion. So the $3 billion might look like a big number, but it may be gone in the next inaugural of the next governor, if we're not careful. So, and the comment by the revenue commissioner the other day of 500 leaves us no shock absorber, and 1.5 to 2 years to implement taxes, it's laughable. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that I encourage you to drive as much as you can a balanced budget this year.
With that, I was remiss in requesting the OMB director to keep this committee informed of any communication that the administration might receive from the Trump administration regarding the comments that Mr. Painter mentioned. There are actions in several different fronts that may affect our budget for next year by the Trump administration, and we need to be kept informed of that and request the current administration to keep this committee informed of any potential changes, so we can make that note to Lacey Sanders, and hopefully we can keep abreast of that oncoming onslaught. Mr. Painter, please proceed.
Senator
Cron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have an amount? So if we're looking at fiscal year 26, we just have the full statutory PFD amount. Do you have an amount that what a 50-50 would be or a 25-75?
Senator Cronk, to the chair, so the full POMV draw is $3.8 billion, so a 50-50 would be $1.9 billion, is half of that. And then a 75-25 would be half of that, so about $950 million. So a little bit larger than last year because the POMV draw is bigger, but
Thank you, Senator Cronk. Please proceed.
So slide 16 shows a version of the swoop graph. I know Director Sanders showed a version. This one compares the previous year to the current year. So on the left side in red, you see the current year's budget, FY25. And then on the right, you see the governor's proposed budget. And this is all the expenses of the state sorted largest to smallest in the governor's budget this year, so the PFD and then the various departments. You can see the comparison from year to year, the increase in the PFD, decrease in education because of the lack of outside the formula or new formula money. And then the other notable change you can see is the decrease in the capital budget. It's hard to see what's going on in a lot of the other agencies because it's pretty small in this graph. Slide 17 is a different way to visualize the budget to sort of show the cash flow. This is showing the UGF revenue and draws and then where it's going. So on the left, you can see our UGF revenue sources, the largest being that POMV draw from the permanent fund. You can see our other revenue sources are petroleum revenue at about $1.7 billion. And, you know, we focus a lot on petroleum revenue, not because it's the largest, but because it's the most volatile. So from year to year, that's often what determines how much is available to spend because it can change so much. But it's actually not our largest source of revenue. Non-petroleum revenue includes investment earnings other than the POMV draw. It includes the corporate income tax, UGF excise taxes, and so forth. And then finally, for the governor's budget, the next source of revenue is a deficit draw from the CBR. That is a source of revenue. It's just not necessarily a sustainable source of revenue that goes to meet the budget. On the right, you can see where that goes. The largest place that the budget goes is the UGF revenue goes is to the agency operations, about $4.5 billion. And you can see the relative size of everything, the statewide items, about $400 million, capital budget, $280 million, and the PFD, $2.5 billion. So that may help you visualize just the relative size of everything in the governor's FY26 budget.
Senator Stedman.
Chairman, it looks like the capital budget is alarmingly small to keep up with the issues around the state, particularly school maintenance and other building maintenance that the state has, just some basic facilities. Isn't there not a provision within the Constitution that requires a certain allocation to the capital budget of our revenue stream?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the constitutional appropriation limit dictates that within the limit, one-third shall be reserved for the capital budget. So it doesn't necessarily say that one-third of our budget will be the capital budget, but if we're spending to the limit, the operating budget can only be two-thirds to that limit. We're at about half the limit right now of the constitutional limit, so it's not really into play, but the two-thirds, one-third is sort of codified, I suppose, in that provision, even though we're nowhere close to that actually limiting our spending. But that was the idea then, is that two-thirds of the limit is for operating, one-third of the limit is for capital.
Senator Stedman.
And what would that roughly one-third be?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, of the limit or of our total budget?
Not of the limit, because we're way under the limit, of the budget. What should that, if we were doing the two-thirds, one-third, what, you know, ballpark range would that be?
So if you look, you know, at our revenue forecasts, UGF revenue is about $6.2 billion. So if a third of that went to the capital budget, that would be, you know, over $2 billion capital budget, certainly a lot larger than $282 million.
Mr. Chairman, I'll negotiate with you a little bit and get some of that back. I would like a little more than $282 million. Out of $2 billion, that's only 10%. Or less than 10%, or not, a little more than 10%, 15% or so.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the risk of saying something that the capital budget co-chair is going to rub my own nose in, but we're still in trouble here. We look at that deficit draw from the CBR number, and at first it looks like going to a 75-25 split erases it because it frees up about $1.6 billion. But we have to keep in mind that Ms. Sanders sat at the end of the table and talked about roughly $200 million more dollars coming in, right? We're I don't think the sentiment among Alaskans is probably to pay $180 million less for education this coming year than we did last year. That's cooked into this. So some other added costs. This is the governor's budget as submitted, but as we look at these things and start to think about, you know, that capital budget number or other numbers in agency operations, boy, it's worse than this. And I just think as we run through this, yeah, I'm not getting anything in my district, am I?
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Painter?
So going on to slide 18, and Director Sanders covered most of these items, but the agency operations total $4.5 billion. That's $57 million above the adjusted base. And I'll just highlight a couple of the large items. I know you've already been through most of these, so I won't go into them in too great a depth. One that she didn't mention is a $7.5 million UGF increase to the Department of Corrections. That's to replace federal funding for mandate billings. There's been a difference of opinion between the state and the U.S. Marshals about who should pay for prisoners who have a joint federal and state hold, meaning they face charges by both. Historically, the federal government would pay for those inmates if they have had a federal both charges. Now they only are paying if they only have federal charges, and that created a significant hole. In addition, there's actually fewer prisoners with federal holds in general now than there were. So we had budgeted to a relatively high number of those prisoners, and now we have fewer of them. So even if the federal government were paying for them, we'd probably still have some of this hole. Last year, the legislature replaced 25% of the projected impact of that. That still leaves a $7.5 million amount in FY26 and a supplemental somewhere in that range. It's unclear exactly how much for FY25 as well. So that's kind of an ongoing issue for the Department of Corrections. There's several increments, and I think the rest of these Director Sanders already covered, so I'm not going to go over the other three. These are just kind of the largest increments. I think I used over $4 million of increments as our filter here. One thing I'll note is there's no significant budget reductions in the governor's budget. There's a couple of things where there's deletion of vacant positions to move them to somewhere else, but there's not really any significant programmatic reductions in the governor's budget. Statewide items, slide 19, they total $414.5 million of UGF. That's actually below the adjusted base because there's an item he's funding at a different level than we put in the adjusted base. He has statutory funding for debt service, the REAA fund deposit, retirement system, and the community assistance fund. But as I noted with the community assistance fund, while the statute says to put in $30 million, it says either $30 million, or you can get it up to $90 million. The balance of that fund is only $70 million because of the veto of that additional $20 last year. So the amount in the fund would currently lead to a distribution of $23.3 million in FY26. So if you wanted a $30 million distribution, you need to either add $6.7 million to top that up to get to 30 in a one-time basis, or you'd need to add $20 million into the fund in FY25. Last year, the legislature kind of attacked that problem from two angles. We topped up the distribution for just the year FY25 only and added $20 million to make the fund whole, which the governor subsequently vetoed. So there's a couple of ways you can handle that if you want to get back up to 90 or want to do a full distribution. The governor has a $13 million UGF deposit to the Disaster Relief Fund that matches the FY25 enacted number. It's below the number, the average usage since, I think we have 8 years of history and that the department has been able to come up with an average usage of $16.8 million. They've said that in a normal year, they go through a bit less than that. That includes the Anchorage earthquake, for example, that had higher costs. In the past, they've also said that it's nice to have a $5 million buffer. So there's some reason to perhaps target a higher number to try to build up that buffer. That's, again, a policy choice of how much you want to put in there, but the $13 million the governor is putting in is below the average usage. Another one of note is the Fire Suppression Fund. That one, the legislature moved out of the agency budget and Department of Natural Resources last year and into the Fire Suppression Fund. That was a fund that hadn't been used in a couple of decades but used to be used for this purpose. The legislature put in last year $49 million of UGF, which is a significant increase above the $13 million or so that we had put in the previous years. In previous years, we had been putting in an appropriation for fire suppression activity, an amount equal to the lowest amount we've spent in the last 10 years, meaning that in 9 out of 10 years, essentially, we'd need a supplemental. The legislature pushed that up close to the average need for fire suppression. I think it was a little bit short because of some negotiations at the end of session, but the legislature did push that up significantly. The governor vetoed that down a little bit to, I think, $35 million or so that went in FY25 in the enacted budget. This year in the governor's budget, he's putting forward 75% of the amount that was enacted last year. And the department's stated reasoning is to try to use previous or this to load 25% of the cost of the fire suppression season in the spring and then 75% in the new year. Since we're already short in FY25, that would mean in order to kind of carry out that plan, we would need to add even more money in the FY25 supplemental when we're facing a deficit. So that's, I guess, a choice for you if you'd like to go with that approach. I'd note that the governor's amount is about half of the average cost of fire suppression. So in most years, you will need a supplemental. Part of the idea that the legislature talked about last year with going to the fund approach and going towards funding closer to the average is that in low years, you could keep money in the fund that would then offset the supplementals in high years. That would give you more stability from year to year in the amount you're putting into fire suppression and reduce the amount of supplementals you have to put in by evening that out. When you're only putting in half the amount, that doesn't really get you there. I would still note, though, that that's the amount in the governor's budget is almost twice what we had in the governor's budget last year. So even with this, we're making significant progress towards a more realistic amount. But again, it's a lot below what you would need to avoid routine supplementals for this item. Going on, is there a question?
Mr. Stedman.
I couldn't help but take the bait. So last year we started using this inactive fund to try to smooth things out. I think the committee, Mr. Chairman, should look at that again. I think it's a better management process than underfunding fires, especially with the bigger fires that we've been having lately. And that way we would have a little more cushion. And in the event that we have a year of small fires, that money would still be sitting in there. I just think it's a better management approach. But I'll leave it up to your leadership, Mr. Chairman, how you want to structure that fire issue. And then hopefully we can, whatever we decide, we can get some support in agreement with the third floor, the governor's office.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Painter.
Going on to the capital budget. So the governor's capital budget is $282 million of UGF, $2.8 billion all funds. So there's the vast majority of our capital budget comes from the federal government. Hopefully we will get all of that, but we have several programs that are largely federal match. And so 55% of the UGF in the governor's capital budget goes to match federal funds. And as I was talking about the year-by-year versus session-by-session comparison, if you're just comparing the UGF capital budget from last year, 25 to 26, you see about a 15% reduction. But if you're comparing what was enacted last session to what the governor's putting forward this session, there's a 38% reduction, so much more significant. And since that federal match amount isn't going down, that's a very large reduction in the kind of discretionary capital, as it would be called, the non-match. So the largest thing in the governor's budget is matching federal funds. Director Sanders went over most of these items, so I'm not going to really go over these too much, but I think bigger picture with the capital budget, there's $20 million going in for deferred maintenance of the state facilities. We have about a $2 billion deferred maintenance backlog, so at $20 million a year, we're not going to get through that backlog. I think nobody would argue that. If you want to try to eat into that backlog, you're going to need to fund something closer to, you know, at least 1 or 2% of the value of state assets. The last time we've gotten a number for that value of state assets was about $9 billion. But that doesn't really factor in IT projects. We see 5 IT projects this year. We don't assign a value to the state's accounting system, right? We can't sell it to somebody, so that's not factored in. But that's a significant cost. The governor has nearly $20 million for IT projects this year. And if you're just starting with that percentage of state assets, that's not really covered. But there are significant IT needs throughout state agencies. The governor's funding five of those projects. We've heard about some others that are perhaps not coming forward yet in other agencies. And I think when we're talking about the deferred maintenance backlog, it also understates really the level of need for state facilities. Because I'll use an example of the Fairbanks Pioneer Home. That particular facility is aging. It's in going into disrepair. I believe it's not actually ADA accessible and has significant roof problems. In the deferred maintenance list, it shows us a few million dollars because that's what you would need to patch it. That's not necessarily going to be sufficient. You need to replace that facility at some point if it's going to continue to be operational. The department says that they estimate replacing that facility would cost $115 million. So just looking at that few million in the deferred maintenance backlog really understates the amount of need. Similarly, if you look at really across our state agencies, a lot of our buildings date back to the construction boom in the early pipeline era from the late 70s and early and mid 80s. We're talking about 40-plus-year-old facilities. A lot of those are in need of replacement. Deferred maintenance is not replacement, and that's not really factored in when we're talking about a $280 million capital budget. You know, we could do federal match plus a Fairbanks Pioneer Home, right? That would be the entire governor's capital budget this year. At some point, the state is going to have to either divest of these facilities and significantly reduce what we do as a state, or we're going to have to invest in maintaining and replacing these facilities. It's not necessarily an option to just continue to allow the Fairbanks Pioneer Home to fall apart. Either we're going to have to find something else to do with those 100 people who live there, or we're going to have to replace that facility. There's not really other options. It's a matter of time. And so when the legislature is trying to build a lasting fiscal plan, I'd really encourage you to try to think about a realistic amount for a capital budget that is sustainable and on an ongoing basis, unless the state wants to significantly reduce its physical footprint from where we are today. And that includes things like prisons. A lot of our prisons are 40-plus years old. Some of them are old Army bases that date back to the 50s, right? One of them here in Juneau is sinking into the silt slowly. We spent several million dollars pulling it out, but it's going to happen again. It's going to keep sinking. You can't just, keep pulling it out every few years. Eventually, we probably need to relocate that facility. So, again, I don't have a particular point on this other than as you're trying to build a fiscal plan, the sustainable capital budget level is probably far larger than what the governor has this year. And the capital budget that the legislature put forward last year, $550 million, a lot of those additional items were not necessarily to state facilities. A lot of those were going to nonprofits. A lot of that was going to local governments. While those are important needs, a lot of those things were not addressing the needs in state facilities, which I understand you can't say, hey, your request for the Fairbanks delegation is $115 million. That is far more than everything else. But those are state facilities that at some point need to be addressed by this committee and the legislature.
Bert will take care of it.
Oops, going the wrong way. So another notable thing I'll mention is, again, what's not in the budget, beyond the capital budget, is education. So we've talked about that a little bit already, but last year there was money outside the foundation formula and outside the pupil transportation formula. Those total $182 million. The governor mentioned a planned $200 million K-12 funding bill when he introduced his budget. Probably don't want to build in a zero for that when you're building your budget, so you probably want to build in something. For Medicaid, the governor's budget does not include an increase to Medicaid funding. On December 15th, the Department of Health submitted a request that, or a projection that said we'd need another $19.6 million UGF. But then after that, they said the day after they received a notice of a federal rate increase that could push that up, and they expect to true that up in the governor's amended budget. And as we've already talked about, also those ongoing bargaining negotiations, we have a very rough placeholder of about $30 million. That assumes a 3% increase for the unions, except for the university, we're assuming the 2.75% that the universities put forward as just a placeholder. I don't know if that's where they'll end up, but again, as a placeholder, it's a starting point. I'd encourage you to put in something for that when you're building the final budget, and we're just putting forward a very rough number of $29.4 million, so it's better than nothing. I think last year we put in an estimate of about $20 million. The final number turned out to be higher because they got higher than the percentage, even though one of the unions, the correctional officers, did not actually come up with a contract. So our placeholder last year was too low, but we're still putting in something because it's helpful to have some number rather than no number. So where does that leave us? This leads into what Senator Keel was talking about earlier, that going to 75-25 alone isn't going to result in a balanced budget in FY26. So the governor's budget has, as we've talked about, a $1.5 billion deficit. If you reduce the PFD to that 75-25 level, that gets you to a balanced budget. But we have these missing items that we know are going to come forward. We know we're going to have additional K-12 funding. $182 million just matches last year. I know there's a lot of people in the building who'd like to see more than that. The projected Medicaid need, again, that's the starting point we have. It may be higher with those federal rate increases. And then the contractual increases, that number could be high or low. That just puts you at about a $200 million deficit, and that's before factoring in things like I mentioned, community assistance and the capital budget and so forth, not factoring in anything else. We're at $200 million just by going to 75-25. And the reason I highlight this is that the last 2 years, the legislature's put forward the 75-25 dividend and been able to have a balanced budget. This year, that is probably not enough. You would need additional revenue or additional spending cuts to get there with the 75-25, or ultimately the legislature will have to come up with another dividend formula for this year. So switching gears a little bit to the more long-term view, if you go back, this graph goes back to our revenue and budget since our big oil price decline that started in 2014. The budgets are represented by the bars in the foreground, and the area in the background represents our revenue. You can see the major difference in our revenue picture starting in FY19 with that purple area coming on. That is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. Since we adopted that, we've seen relatively balanced budgets, especially out of the kind of first couple of years. Over the last 5 years, we've run relatively balanced budgets. We've had some years where we've had to draw a little bit from the last of the SBR. We used some federal money for revenue replacement from the COVID funds, and we did have a CBR draw when oil prices declined. But as a whole, the last few years, we've run relatively balanced budgets, and we've seen the CBR balance start to grow from where it was at the lowest point around FY18. So we're in an era of relatively balanced budgets, but it's ad hoc balanced budgets. It's by picking a PFD formula every year. It's by picking a capital budget number every year. We don't have a structurally balanced budget. The governor's budget gives you an idea, and the governor's 10-year plan, of what our structural deficit is because he has the statutory dividend in. So as we move forward to the long-term outlook, this is showing the long-term revenue outlook. The Department of Revenue's fall forecast projects that oil prices will be relatively flat, $70 and then $68 to $69 and then slightly above. Oil production is projected to increase significantly from under 500,000 barrels a day to over 650,000. But that's not really going to lead to a significant increase in revenue because of the structure of our tax system, where a lot of that revenue will be deferred due to carried forward tax liabilities for some of these, or tax credits for some of these developments, and for the gross value reduction that enables new production to pay a lower amount for the first few years of production. So we don't see a significant increase in revenue despite that increase in production. This graph compares our revenue to the dotted line, which is FY26 revenue growing with inflation. And you can see that basically it doesn't quite keep pace with inflation, and then towards the end it gets up there. But essentially what this highlights is that based on the revenue forecast, despite the increase in production, we're not going to see more revenue in the future. If you can't balance your budget this year, you're not going to balance your budget in any of the forecast period because your revenue picture doesn't change. It's basically just growing with inflation. And so if you can't balance this year, there's no, you know, these new developments aren't going to save us and bring a ton more revenue. If we can't balance at $70 this year, probably can't balance at $68, $69, or $71, or whatever these other prices are in the forecast going forward. So if we have that structural imbalance, that's going to persist, and that's what we see in the governor's 10-year plan. Another thing I'll highlight is the earnings reserve account, or ERA, the sufficiency of that. So the earnings reserve account in the permanent fund is the spendable portion. The principal is not spendable, but the earnings reserve is spendable. The permanent fund corporation has a projection for statutory net income. That's the amount that is realized each year and can become spendable, goes into the ERA. Their projection is 6.25%. Their total return projection is 7.65%. So their projection is that there will be a growing balance of unrealized gains in the fund over time. That's compared to an inflation rate of 2.5%. So if you do the math there, 2.5% inflation, 5% POMV, that exceeds the 6.25% draw, even with the lag. And so that leads to a projection that the ERA balance will decline. The graph here compares the realized ERA balance. That's the spendable amount. There is, in the accounting world, some of the unrealized gains are assigned to the ERA. Some are assigned to the principal. Ultimately, we can't actually spend it until it's realized. We have to sell the assets to spend them. So only the realized income is spendable. So that's what we're considering here. You can see that's on the left, starting with FY22. And then on the right is the following year's POMV draw. So essentially, this is comparing what do you have in the fund on June 30th with what do you owe the general fund on July 1st, the next day. And so the projection is that starting in FY31, and this is just a straight line projection, we will have less money in the earnings reserve account on June 30th than what the ERA will owe to the general fund the next day. Of course, they don't need the money all on day one. They have a little bit of time to realize it over time as we work through cash flow. But I think that should be a warning flag to you. This is assuming full inflation proofing each year, the statutory inflation proofing happening each year, and that's the assumption that the permanent fund corporation has. The governor this year in his budget did not put forward an inflation proofing appropriation. The last 2 years, the legislature has reduced the amount below the full projection. 2 years ago, FY24, we put in an amount that was capped at $1.4 billion, which was the estimate. So essentially, if inflation was higher than the projection, we wouldn't pay additional amounts in. And then this year, we capped it at $1 billion, so below the estimate. So the legislature has been acting to try to avoid this problem. But if we continue inflation proofing and following that statute, we would run out of money in the ERA. Our probabilistic modeling shows that even if we stop inflation proofing, when you get down below, like to that FY31 level, we would show a 46% chance of not having enough money to make the ERA, the full POMV payment. If we suspend inflation proofing when you drop that off, that dropped to 33%. A one-third risk is still pretty high because that would be a risk that we wouldn't be able to pay out our full budget. And at that point, you are kind of going month by month in terms of realizing income. So this is something to really watch. We do have a significant policy lever that can control this through our inflation proofing appropriations. So that's one of the largest decisions in dollar amounts the legislature has to make this year. Should we put forward that $1.4 billion or so of inflation proofing or not? The governor's choice in his budget was no. And when you're making that calculation, it's really balancing between two risks. One risk is that because of market volatility, there will not be enough money in the earnings reserve to make that full statutory POMV payment. The other risk is that a future legislature will choose to overdraw that POMV amount if there's extra money sitting around. You could say that, well, we should never inflation proof because then we'll never risk running out of money in the ERA. But we've seen when there's a lot of money in the ERA, proposals by the governor and one body of the legislature to overdraw the ERA in order to make the budget. So the legislature has to weigh those risks and decide how to go forward. I can't tell you what to do because it's really a policy choice, but you're really weighing those two risks against each other.
Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's one area that I think the committee needs to look at, and that's the asset allocation within the permanent fund. They have, in my opinion, too heavily have weighted illiquid assets that don't produce realized returns, maybe upwards of a decade. And that forces the rest of the fund to carry the load. So there's that policy issue, which is significant. In my opinion, there's a mismatch between the customer, us, or the client, us, and their asset allocation direction from their consultants, which is to maximize the rate of return for the risk level. That's all said and good, but fees go up, realized earnings go down, and it doesn't work. So I'm concerned about that. And then also the 5%. I think the 5% is at the max, maybe too high, even with an asset allocation adjustment. And I think we'll probably talk about that in future discussions. But the permanent fund needs to be cognizant of their client, which is the state, and our needs, not consultants packing briefcases from out of state coming up with good ideas that increase our fees and push us into liquidity.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Okay, slide 26, we're getting into the governor's 10-year plan, and Director Sanders covered this earlier, but we'll start by showing our modeling baseline and then compare it to the 10-year plan. So when Ledge Finance is doing a modeling baseline, in the past we've sometimes used adjusted base. Because of the amount of education funding flowing outside the formula at this point, using adjusted base we feel like does not really provide an accurate view of a likely place the legislature will end up this session. So this year we're starting our modeling by assuming last year's budget growing with inflation. Just the nature of funding, 11% of your largest budget item outside the formula through one-time appropriations means we really have to go off of last year if we're trying to build a realistic starting point. So in our model, with our baseline, there's substantial budget deficits every year, which illustrates just our deficit. So in our baseline model, which is assuming statutory PFD payments, it assumes last year's budget growing with inflation, we'd have significant deficits. You can see the deficits going up here, starting at $1.8 billion, peaking at over $2.1 billion, nearly $2.2 billion in FY35. This graph compares the expenditures to our available revenue. The gap here shows that there is not enough revenue and available reserves to make our budget. This is assuming we follow the statutory POMV and we don't overdraw. The reason we assume that here is essentially just so we can see what the baseline is before you start trying to fill it in. Sometimes if we just start with the ERA overdraws, it looks like a death spiral, but it maybe overstates the real size of the deficit. So really, on an ongoing basis, that's the size of our deficit here. This shows our reserve levels. We're assuming that we hold in the CBR $500 million for cash flow, and then the ERA here, this is assuming it stabilizes and we don't inflation-proof beyond the point where we would not have enough to pay the last or the next year's POMV draw, so that's stabilizing at the amount of the following year's POMV draw, essentially. This is the same model, but then showing those ERA overdraws to make up the deficit. So in this case, we'd start drawing in from the ERA in FY27 and then draw it down and not be able to make those full amounts and still have that white space, meaning there's not available revenue starting in FY31. Again, I don't want to dwell on this too much. I think we know that if you start out with a massive deficit and don't fill it, it's going to remain. The point of this is just to illustrate the size of the hole that you have to deal with if you start at the statutory PFD and last year's budget size. Oh, yes.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Painter. On slide 27, where it says effective POMV draw rate, but then you have 5% flat across there, that's more of that's the nominal draw rate, not actually the effective draw rate, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, so the comparison there is that we're actually following the statutory POMV, or here when we're overdrawing, you see that number mm-hmm. goes over 5%. So we're not saying the percent of the current market value, it's saying with overdraws factored in, what POMV draw would that equal? So sometimes people have said, you know, if we're going to overdraw $1 billion, our real POMV would be 6% instead of 5, you know, something like that. So that's what we're trying to account for with that figure.
Thank you.
So the governor's 10-year plan is different than our model in that it bases the numbers in the out years on the governor's FY26 budget and then has them grow with inflation. And so because the governor's FY26 budget does not include that additional K-12 funding, it doesn't include all sorts of other things that were one-time items last year, there's a pretty big difference there between our baseline and the governor's 10-year plan just because of the choice of fiscal year that's your starting point. There's a couple of assumption differences that I'll note between when we model his plan and when the executive branch puts forward their 10-year plan. One of those is that the governor assumes supplementals and LAPs cancel out. We assume that there's continued supplementals. If we perhaps brought fire suppression closer to the average funding level and disaster relief to the average funding level and so forth, perhaps we could have a different assumption. But as long as we have kind of structural imbalances in those programs, I think that placeholder is probably still needed. We also include a placeholder for new school debt after the moratorium ends this year. The governor just follows the current schedule, which is, of course, the published schedule, so I get why they do that. But we think that understates the long-term cost, because based on the current policy, which is that moratorium will lift, we'll see more school debt. I think the amount that we have in there is probably an understatement of the true amount. We basically took the amount that was being added new school debt before the school debt moratorium ended and then assumed that level resumes. Realistically, there's probably a bit of a backlog saved up where school districts have been waiting for that program to come back, and we'll see more than an average amount come forward in the first couple of years. So I think our placeholder there is probably a little too small, but we don't really have anything to go on in terms of where that would actually be. So we just have a relatively small placeholder. Another difference is that there was an error in the permanent funds projections that they had that were used in the fall forecast. They used the wrong number for the FY25 returns. That changes both the dividend projections. So the statutory PFD projection in the governor's budget is about $50 million too high. And it also influences the amount of the POMV draws in the out years. We're using the corrected numbers that we worked with the Permanent Fund Corporation on. The Department of Revenue has confirmed that they will use the corrected numbers in the spring forecast as well. So that all said, if we compare the our baseline to the governor's 10-year plan, you notice a pretty significant difference, about $400 million growing over time between our baseline and the governor's 10-year plan. That's, again, that choice of where your base is. We're assuming that the base is last year's spending growing with inflation. His assumption is the governor's budget, which, as we've talked about, is missing a couple $100 million of appropriations. So we think our baseline is probably closer to where you'll end up for the year, absent policy changes. To get to the governor's budget level would require essentially a large reduction in K-12 spending and other things. So it's, I suppose, reflecting a policy choice that the governor's budget is lower, or it's just where they are at this point. But for our modeling, our baseline is significantly higher. If you put the governor's 10-year plan into the our model, we don't draw the CBR below zero like the governor's 10-year plan, so we just have this kind of white space as showing the gap rather than a negative CBR. But we get to a pretty similar place, despite the difference in projections and these assumptions. They're relatively minor in the big picture. They similarly show that $1.5 billion deficit growing over time to about $1.7, $1.8 billion, similar to the governor's 10-year plan that Director Sanders shared with you earlier. If you try to fill that with the ERA, that will last through FY32, and then you start having unfunded amounts in FY33. Again, I don't think anybody intends you to actually go with this plan, but this shows you at least the size of the gap. And that is all I have for today. I'm happy to answer any additional questions that the committee may have.
That we're going to go into good news.
Mr. Chairman, the good news is we have a very capable committee capable of dealing with the state's problems.
Thank you for that presentation. Do we have any questions for Alexi Painter? Point. Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just explain to the public, you hit on it, we're going to see an increase of oil production but not necessarily revenue, just so the people out there listening.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Cronk. So as we see an increase in oil production, new oil is treated differently than current production for a couple of reasons. One is that one of the major projects that's expected to come online is from a company that doesn't currently have production. And so for that company, as they've been making investments, they're gathering carried forward annual losses, because right now as they're investing, they're losing money. They can carry forward those losses as credits. And when they start production, they can apply those credits against their production tax. What that means is that the first few years of production, we won't get significant production taxes from that field because they'll be using those credits. The other major field that's under development is from a company that has current production. For that company, they can deduct their costs of development against their existing production, so that results in less production tax in the lead up to that field coming online. We will see more revenue going forward after that happens, after it comes online. But that other field is not on state land, meaning that we would not get royalty payments. So there's kind of there's four parts really of our oil revenue. There's the production tax, there's our royalties, there's the corporate income tax, and then there is the property tax. And so when there's production that's not on state land, we can get the production tax, we can get the corporate income tax, and we can get the property tax, but we don't get that royalty piece, which is often the largest piece, depending on where the oil price forecast is. Additionally, one of the major companies on the slope does not pay corporate income taxes because of their structure. So, you know, that company, which is one of the big players, doesn't pay into one of those four large revenue sources. And so as their production would go up, you wouldn't necessarily see them paying into that source. So the combination of all those things just means that as that production goes up, you don't necessarily see a significant spike in revenue, because we get a lot more revenue from the legacy fields than we would from those new fields. The other factor is the gross value reduction. So for the first 7 years of production, if prices are under $70, or 3 years if their prices are over $70, the companies can deduct a portion of, or reduce the amount they pay on those new fields. The idea of that was to incentivize production of new fields, but it does mean when those new fields come online, you see less production tax revenue from them. And so in the forecast period, that's the big effect you're seeing, where despite the additional production, we really don't see more revenue.
Thank you, Senator Cronk. Meeting back to order. We were scheduled to meet on Friday to go over any additional questions that members might have with Mr. Painter, but seeing none, we'll go ahead and cancel that meeting. And our next meeting will be on Monday. With that, we stand adjourned.